classes that I've been working on with Shane Davidson, and then I'll conclude. So here's the lightning review of the standard model Higgs mechanism. The idea is, in the standard model, you introduce a single complex SE2 doublet scalar field, call it phi. You write down a scalar potential, the minimum of which is not at zero field value. That triggers electronic symmetry breaking, by which the doublet gets a vacuum expectation value V, which is fixed by the parameters of the scalar potential. The physical Higgs is this real neutral degree of freedom. The other degrees of freedom, the CP odd and the charged states, become the would-be Goldstone bosons. These can be gauged away by an appropriate gauge choice, so they're not physical degrees of freedom in the spectrum. And then the covariant derivative term for the Higgs, like this U mu phi, when you write it out in terms of the gauge interactions and plug in the V, gives rise to the gauge boson masses, the weak boson masses in the usual way, with the important thing being the dependence on the BEV, okay, the dependence on the gauge couplings, and the fact that the coefficient here is the same, the numerical coefficient is the same, has to do with the group structure, the fact that phi is a doublet under SU2. The Yukawa Lagrangian looks like this. So here are the fermion couplings with some 3x3 in generation space Yukawa matrices in front. Again, when you plug in the vacuum expectation value, you generate fermion mass matrices. Diagonalizing these gives you the fermion masses, and simultaneously diagonalizes the Yukawa couplings. The CPM matrix then arises from the mismatch in the rotation you have to do to diagonalize the mass matrix for the down type quarks and the mass matrix for the up type quarks, and that shows up because U and V both live in the fork doublet and weak interactions talk between members of the single doublet. So there are two automatic features which are just preserved automatically in the standard model and have been tested experimentally and have to generally be put in by hand in extended models. One of these is custodial symmetry. Basically, the statement here is essentially this statement about the coefficient of these two masses being the same. And the upshot is that if you go out and measure cosine theta W, so you measure that ratio of gauge couplings, and you plug it in with the W and the Z masses, you get one at tree level. This is also maintained in extended Higgs sectors if the extended Higgs sector contains only SU2 doublet scalar fields. Singlets, you can always throw in because they don't contribute to the gauge boson masses. It turns out that there are additional larger representations with particular choices of hypercharge that accidentally satisfy this, but I don't want to talk about that in this. So if you add doublets, you maintain this automatically. And in two doublet models, for example, the covariant derivative term just gets duplicated, giving you gauge boson masses, which are sums of contributions from the vacuum expectation values of each of those two fields. And obviously, this preserves the ratio. And simultaneously requires that the sum of the squares of these couplings have to add up to the standard model vacuum expectation. Now, with two doublets, you get four more real scalar degrees of freedom. You have four from here, four more from the second doublet. The sum of the squares of these BEVs is constrained, but the ratio is a free parameter of the model, usually called tangent beta. And the mass eigenstates are linear combinations of these states. So the CP even neutral states mix to form two physical Higgs-like states. The CP odd guys mix to form a Goldstone boson. Okay, likewise for the charged states. The composition of this is fixed by the ratio of the BEVs, and the orthogonal states are new physical particles in the spectrum, the CP odd and the charged states. Okay? So if you take these two doublets and rotate by that same mixing angle, or the ratio of BEVs beta, okay, you can write things in the so-called Higgs spaces, where the BEV and the Goldstones all live in one doublet, and the charged states and the pseudoscalar live over here along the sum linear combination of the neutral guys, so these are the mass eigenstates. And the upshot of that is that if you look at W couplings, charged states and A basically talk to each other via W, and you get interaction to this linear combination of those states. Okay. Of course, there's also the photon coupling and the Z coupling. Okay. The second automatic feature preserved in the standard model is that there are no flavor-changing neutral Higgs interactions. And the reason for that was just that when you have your mass matrix, you have your Yukawa matrix, they're proportional to each other, diagonalize one and the other is automatically diagonalized. If you have a generic multi-Higgs doublet model, so here's two doublets, and I've just written down the down quark Yukawa couplets, okay? The most general thing you can write is two independent complex 3x3 matrices of Yukawa couplings in front of each of those terms, and then the mass matrix gets two contributions. When you diagonalize this, you do not necessarily diagonalize these two things individually. You only diagonalize their sum. Okay? And so in general, there are non-diagonal elements in Yukawa couplings, and this leads to neutral Higgs. Okay, flavor change neutral Higgs couplings. Okay. Which is experimentally a problem if they're large, because you can get, for example, you have a neutral Higgs coupling to a down quark and a strange quark, then you can get tree level contributions to, say, KK bar mixing from Higgs exchange, and those are tightly constrained. So either you need to put stringent limits on how big the off diagonal elements of these guys can be, or you can impose a symmetry to forbid the flavor changing contributions. And this idea was invented in the 70s. It's called natural flavor conservation, and basically, if you generate the mass of each type of fermion, so by that I mean up-type quarks, down-type quarks, or charged leptons, as the different types of fermions, the things that can mask, the things that can mix with each other to give them mass eigenstates. If each of these gets this mass from exactly one Higgs, then this mass matrix has only one term, and if you diagonalize the mass matrix, you diagonalize the Yukawas. So I will assume this for the rest of the talk. Once you assume that, there are four different ways to assign the fermion couplings. Okay? And that defines the four two Higgs doublet models, okay? The familiar type 1 and type 2 models, and then two other choices, which in this talk I'm going to call leptonic and flipped. In the leptonic model, basically, the quarks get their mass from one doublet, and the leptons get their mass from the other doublet. In the flipped model, it's just like the type 2 model, except the leptons get their mass from the same doublet as the up-type quarks, as opposed to the down-type quarks. The type 2 model is probably the most familiar to people because that's the structure that appears naturally in the MSSM, and it's actually forced in the MSSM by holomorphicity of the superpotential. Basically, you can't, phi tilde is the conjugate of the SU2 doublet, and you can't put that into the superpotential, so you actually have to introduce a second scalar, a second chiral multiplet Higgs field with opposite hypercharge to couple to the up-type quarks. So this structure gives rise to the following physics, in particular the couplings of the charged Higgs to up and down quarks, or to neutrinos and leptons, together with the mixing angle that gives you the charged Higgs mass eigenstate. You wind up getting basically factors of tangent data or cotangent data multiplying the mass of the particle when you express the couplings of these guys in terms of the physical masses. Vij is the CKM matrix. So the physics, if you're going to do phenomenology of the charged Higgs, the physics is controlled by this parameter tangent data and by the charged Higgs mass and depends on which model you're living in. Most experimental studies have been done for the type 2 to the example model because that's the structure that appears in the MSSM. So just to give you a sense of what this looks like, here are some plots of the decay branch ratios of the charged Higgs into fermions as a function of tangent data on the x-axis for these four models from a paper by Aoki and collaborators. They use a different naming convention for the leptonic and the flipped model. There isn't really a very well-established convention for those names in the literature. Every paper you read, it's different. But you can see the pattern. Basically, in the type 2 model, you go to larger tangent data, you enhance the coupling to tau mu. Similarly here, and in the flipped model, you basically trade off the leptonic decay for some quark decay at large tangent data. I'll show these again as I go on. Okay. So what are the constraints? Well, left set limits on charged Higgs pair production. Basically, you go to plus H minus where the charged Higgs can decay to tau nu, okay, or charm strange, or some combination of the two. And basically, the left combined limit is shown here in yellow. And this is assuming that the sum of these two branching ratios adds up to 1, which is certainly a good approximation for the type 2 tuning sublet model. This next node is down at sort of the 1.5% level. And so the overall limit from left was about a little below 80 GeV. If you go up to the ends, you do a little bit better. There's a separate OPAL analysis that set a limit on the charge shaking mass of about 92 GeV. And essentially, part of the reason why there's this wall here is that the W mass is right there. So that gives you a sense of the left limit, sort of 80 to 90 GeV on the charge tanks. Tevatron has also done charge tank searches, and in particular, looking for charge tanks in top decay. So the idea here is that top can decay, instead of going to bottom W for gauge coupling, can go to bottom and charge tanks if the charge tank is light enough. And the coupling that controls that is this coupling here. Okay. Notice the features of this at low tangent data. This coupling gives you a large contribution to the decay branch ratio, the decay width. At large tangent data, this coupling is going to give you a significant decay width. And in the middle, your decay width is just small. Okay. So typically, this type of search will constrain the charge takes and tangent data at the high end and the low end for tangent. And the experimental data, I'm just kind of showing the branching ratio limits. For charge states to tau nu, you're limiting the branching ratio at about the 10 to 20% level for the top k. And if charge states goes to charm strange, you're again at sort of the 10 to 30% level. Again, here's the W right in there. And this study, actually, the way they do it is they look, one top goes leptonically in the normal way, the other top goes to assuming charge takes W, and you look at the invariant mass of the two jets from the charge takes and look for a peak that's sitting off the W peak.
So how does T0 do something at 80 GeV there? I mean, there must be lots of top quarks decaying to WB. That's how we see it.
This is something that I need to look into more, and I think the way that they do it is some kind of lepton flavor universality compared to the W's. Because the W goes basically equally to the three flavors, mm-hmm. but the charge tanks goes entirely to tau nu, essentially.
So it's a limit on the W to tau branching ratios.
I think so. This is something that, but we're still kind of working on this stuff, and this is something, this is on my to-do list to figure out exactly what they do. Okay, and then finally, let me just say two words about the LHC search prospects, and then we'll again come back to this. There are two main channels that the LHC studies look at. One being, again, Higgs production in top decay, just the same as the Tevatron, except at the LHC you have a lot more statistics, so you can basically bring this in a lot more towards this moderate tangent beta region where you just don't have sensitivity because the top to charge shift branching ratio just is small. Okay. And these studies have all been done looking at charged tanks to tau here. For a heavier charged tanks, or even still below the top threshold, there's also an associated production mode. So top and charged tanks associated production. This is basically through bottom gluon fusion. And here's the coupling again, right? Bottom gluon fusion, at very low tangent beta, you get your enhancement. And at high tangent beta, you also get an enhancement. And that explains the shape of these contours here. So out at higher tangent beta, you're decaying sort of. And people have looked actually at this channel, both with charge states goes to top bottom, so above the TB threshold of about 180 GeV, and also charge states goes to tau nu, and so that's a combined plot. Okay, so let me now, having sort of reviewed the standard picture, talk about these more exotic models. And I'm just I'll start with the lepton specific model, and then I'll do the flip one, and then I'll talk about the geomass model. And my goal here is to show how the existing experimental studies translate onto these models, and whether they translate, and what other signatures might be productive to look at. So the main difference between the lepton specific or leptonic 2-gig sublet model and the type 2 model is the down type pair Jeremy on top of it. And so basically we're in the MSSM, we have this tangent beta enhancement of basically the bottom port coupling to the Higgs sector. Here it's actually a suppression, right? The couplings to fermions, or the couplings to quarks, actually take the same pattern as in the type 1 cubic sublet problem. And so there's a constraint from beta S gamma, the same as in type 1, and this has been calculated first in the 80s, early 90s, maybe even earlier. And then it was looked at recently by Siobhan Su and her student, which basically constrains tangent beta to be a little bit greater than 1. Okay, so 4 for relatively light charge states, and then a weaker constraint for heavier charge states. The production rates in the LHC search channels that I just mentioned, so top 2 charge states bottom, and also top Higgs associated production, are then suppressed entirely by cotangent beta. So there's cotangent beta on both of these terms in the production cross section. And so in particular, you don't get the enhancement at large temp beta that you get in the cubic sublet problem, K2. The couplings to leptons are still enhanced at large tangent beta because the taus usually dominate. And actually, this model was used in as part of a model earlier this year by the Berkeley group as a messenger of dark matter. The idea that it decays entirely leptonically would get you your positron excess without getting an antiproton excess. For dark matter annihilation, is to explain this Pamela and Adam, positron quantum gray excess. So what are the constraints? Well, below the top-bottom threshold, so top-bottom threshold basically means charge states mass below about 180 GeV, the decays are almost entirely to tau nu. So remember I just said beta S gamma sort of cuts you off here, and you're essentially all tau nu. Okay? So you can just use the left limit from Opal, 92 GeV, for the mass of this guy, and that's your little amount. There's also a constraint here from lepton universality and tau decays. This shows up also in the type 2 Higgs sublet model. The idea is just instead of exchanging a W, you exchange a Higgs and then take the interference. Okay? And that excludes for you, this plot didn't come out as well as I hoped, excludes for you a wedge proportional to tangent beta. So this sort of kicks in at relatively large tangent beta, which is accessible in this model because you don't have to worry about perturbativity in the bottom of the tau. Okay, so what about the LHC variants? Well, basically they're not too good. The decays are to tau nu, so here are some plots showing the branching fractions as a function of the charge state's mass for various tangent beta values. And you can see the TB threshold here. As you crank up tangent beta, tau nu basically starts to completely dominate. Okay? The production rates in top charge states bottom, and also this B gluon fusion mode, are suppressed by cotangent squared beta, so those are always going to be lower, no matter as you increase tangent beta. And so instead, you really have to rely on leptonic production. The cross sections are not huge. Oh, the cross sections are not awful. You're talking about 100 to 300 seventh of arcs, okay, for 100 GeV charge takes. Or if you go up to 300 GeV, you're down to sort of the 10 tenth of arcs level, so not great cross sections. And the decays are to tau nu, so you basically have 2,000 missing energy, which is not a very hot signal either. Okay. If you're willing to take the hit in the branching ratio of 2 powers of the muon mass over the tau mass, you might look for this channel, but it's pretty rare. Sorry, you might look for tau, PT miss, and 2 muons that deconstruct the mass of the neutral, but it's very rare. Okay, so that's maybe not so exciting. The flipped 2 Higgs doublet model is a little more exciting. The flipped 2 Higgs doublet model, again, the quark coupling structure is identical to the type 2, but the leptons are, the lepton and tau coupling is proportional to cotangent beta instead of tangent beta. And as a result of that, the production, the couplings to quarks have the same pattern as in the type 2 model. The production rates in the LHC production modes are identical. Okay, so your cross sections are the same. Your branching ratios are different. Okay. The other thing another feature of this model is you do have, again, this constraint from V to S gamma, which is identical to that in the type 2 model, which actually gives you a lower limit on the charge fixed mass of about 200 to 300 GeV, depending on how exactly you do the analysis. And the caveat I want to put here is that, you know, in the MSSM, you look for charge takes down to the left direct search bound. Why is that, even though you have the speed S gamma constraint? The reason is that in the MSSM, you also get contributions from Chargino and Topscore loops, which can cancel the charge takes contribution to V to S gamma, so it opens that parameter space back up. So the caveat I want to make here is that other flavor violating contributions or other stuff that can run in the loop can always cancel off these indirect constraints. And so while the charge takes below this mass is disfavored, I would say, it's not purely excluded if you allow the possibility of other stuff in the model. So I'll make fuss for that as well. The couplings to leptons are proportional to cotangent beta instead of tangent beta. And the major effect that has is on the decay branching ratios of this charge case. And so this is the plot for the flipped model. This is the plot for the type 2 model. And you can see essentially the tau mu mode dependence on the tan beta is essentially inverse. Okay? So at low tangent beta, you'll decay to tau mu, like 90% of the time. Higher tangent beta above about 3 or so, the decays are mostly to charm and bottom, okay? And then at sort of the 30% level, to charm strange. Okay? The reason that charm bottom surpasses charm strange, where in the type 2 model it's charm strange that's dominant here, is that up here you're basically taking advantage of the bottom fork Yukawa coupling, which is enhanced by tangent beta. And down here, you're taking advantage of the charm fork Yukawa coupling, down here, cotangent beta is large. Okay? The charm bottom, so you lose by a factor of VCD, the CKM matrix element, but the bottom Yukawa coupling is so much bigger than the strange fork Yukawa coupling that you still overdraw this movement. This is important for the left searches. Okay? So in the left searches, some of the collaborations, some of the LEP experiments, actually actively rejected bottom forks in their charge kick search because they're doing tau nu or charm strange, right? There's no bottoms there. Reject bottoms, you beat down some of the W background, and other backgrounds, I guess, right? And so this is no good for this mode. Opal and Aleph just looked for jets, so they didn't do any flavor selection or flavor rejection. And so if you use these experimental collaborations results directly, then they're applicable to this model. Okay, so we did that, we looked at them both. The Aleph was a little bit stronger, the limits, and overall they exclude charge takes up to about 78 GeV, okay? With slightly higher for either all the QQ bar or all the tau nu. And again, 78 GeV, it's very comparable to the LEP combined. So you don't lose much in it. As for top fork decay at the tevatron, basically you can take the existing tevatron analyses and essentially flip around the decay modes as a function of tangent data and re-extract the limits for this model. And so that's what we've done. Basically, this is still very preliminary. What we did for low tangent beta, the charge fixed branching ratios are about the same. Well, they're actually, for tangent beta equals 1, they're identical in the two models. For tangent beta close to 1, they're fairly close, okay, in the flipped model and the type 2 model. So we just took the tevatron limits at low tangent beta directly from the zero paper. For tangent beta greater than about 3, this guy's decaying to quarks, okay? And so I took the limits from the CDF search, which looked for top two charge states, bottom of the charge states going to digets, and just translated them based on the cross-section times, or based on the top branching ratio times the charge state branching ratio. And the limits on tangent beta are sort of in the 30 to 60 GeV range as you vary the charge states. I should make a caveat here. The CDF study simulated charm strange. They did a did a check actually with up-down to see if they can include that in the study. Really, the only difference is that up-down has a slightly better diejet energy resolution, or diejet invariant mass resolution, so that's actually a little better. They haven't looked specifically at bottom charm, but we'd expect you'll get a slightly worse diejet invariant mass resolution because of the bottom decay you lose neutrino and that sort of thing. But it should be pretty comparable. So what about the LHC prospects? And here I think things are kind of interesting because the production couplings are identical to the type 2 model. So the production of the charge takes in top decay and the production of the charge takes in muon bottom fusion should be the same. Okay. Below the top-bottom threshold, decays are to tau mu for low values of tangent beta, but quickly switch over to this QQ bar, so bottom charm or charm strange, for tangent beta above about 3. Okay, and so there you have an issue because the charge takes is decaying into jets. Can you see it? Above the top-bottom threshold, you're basically always decaying into top-bottom. So there, it's sort of the same picture as in the type 2 model. Right, so looking at the charge takes production in top decays, all of the LHC studies have been done assuming the charge takes goes to tau nu. So in this model, that's not applicable. Essentially, we would need to do the same thing that the CDF study did and look for a jet-jet invariant mass peak. I don't know whether that's possible in the jet background environment of the LHC, but that would be what one would have to do. Okay. For a heavier charge takes, the decay to top-bottom dominates. So it's basically exactly the same picture as in the type 2 model, and you can just carry over the results verbatim. And the 5-sigma discovery prospects in this mode, okay, with top case associated production, based again on the Atlas CSC book, are sort of for various tangent beta values in this kind of range. So above the top bottom threshold and up to about sort of 200, 300 GeV. And I should say, below this mass, all the studies have looked at decays to tau mu, so we can't say anything about this model. Okay, so I want to move on then and talk about this two doublet model for neutrino masses that I mentioned. Basically, this is a model that my student and I have been developing and looking at the phenomenology of. The idea, the motivation is to make a model for Dirac neutrino masses, right? So Dirac masses for the neutrinos using an extended Higgs structure below the TeV scale. So what we've done is added three right-handed neutrinos. These are going to marry up with the left-handed standard model neutrinos and form Dirac particles. And we have the second Higgs doublet, essentially. To keep all hell from breaking loose, we put in a new symmetry, a global U1, okay, that our mu states are charged under. This prevents a Majorana mass term for the right-handed neutrinos so that we keep them to be Dirac neutrinos. And it also fixes the structure of the Yukawa couplings. So the Yukawa coupling involving the right-hand neutrinos has to involve Phi2, this mu Higgs. All of the other Yukawa couplings for the right-handed standard model fermions involve the original standard model Higgs. Okay, so this Phi2 is only responsible for neutrino masses, essentially. To generate the neutrino masses, we have to break the U1. And if you break it spontaneously, you run into trouble because you get Boltzmann bosons. So we break it explicitly. So we stick in a term in the scalar potential. This is just a soft breaking term of this U1, quite similar to what you do in two Higgs doublet models where you have a symmetry to force the couplings of the Higgs to different fermion types. And if you make M12 of order of 200 keV, then you wind up with a BEV of this second doublet around the neutrino mass scale. So we do that. And then what are the particles? Well, basically, you've got now Dirac neutrinos. There are no extra fermionic degrees of freedom beyond that. And you've got the new scalar degrees of freedom from the second double. Okay? And because this BEV is very, very tiny, there's almost no mixing between these states and the standard model states. So it's really kind of a new sector. Okay? They couple via the neutrino Yukawa matrix. So the couplings are controlled by the actual neutrino mass eigenstate masses, and the neutrino analog of the CKM matrix is the neutrino mixing matrix, the MMSG matrix. Okay. The right-handed neutrinos get populated in the early universe through charge takes exchange, okay, because it talks to right-handed neutrino and left-handed charge lepton. And so there's actually a constraint from mid-band nucleosynthesis that you can't have these Yukawa couplings be too big. The limit is about the Yukawas have to be less than about 1/30, which is sort of the size of the standard model bottom fork Yukawa couple. So not super tiny. Okay? And this corresponds to a BEV for the second doublet of about 2 electron volts. Okay, so what's the phenomenology? Yeah.
Can I ask a question? So sure, sure. Why do you have to make V2 so small? I mean, you could also make the Yukawa couplings very small. Right?
Yeah, yeah. So the motivation is basically we wanted to find a way you could force the neutrino small with a single parameter that could then be explained in some Yukawa completion of the bottle. Just making the Yukawa coupling small, basically you need 9 complex numbers to be magnitude less than like 10 to the minus 11, which you can do with a model of flavor, but this is our choice to keep the Yukawa couplings order 1 and to control the neutrino mass scale with 1. So, I mean, there's other things you can do. So.
This is, you're likely to have more problems with technical naturalness with that, keeping that BEV small as opposed to Yukawa coupling.
It's because there's only one term that breaks the U1, though. It's technically natural. Because if this term were 0, then the U1 would be an additional substrate. So radiative corrections to this are proportional to this. I mean, the M11 and M22 have the same problems as in the second problem.
You don't think there's a hierarchy problem with this guy?
Not for this one, but for these two, yeah, just as an example. Everything talked about it a lot. Okay, yeah, so I wanted to talk about the K modes. So the neutral guys basically go to neutrinos. We couldn't figure out a way to detect that. And the charged guy goes to electron to neutrino. And in fact, the decays, the decay partial widths, are actually controlled by this, essentially the expectation value of the neutrino mass squared in a flavor eigenstate. Okay, so if you want to go to electron plus neutrino, you look at the effective electron neutrino mass squared. Okay. The branching ratios are just the ratios of this divided by the sum. And these are identical to the branching ratios of the singly charged scalar in the type 2 seesaw model, which has a Higgs triplet in it. So the decays are the same. These are the branching ratios in the normal hierarchy and the inverted hierarchy as a function of the lightest neutrino mass. And what's going on here is basically when all the neutrinos are degenerate, it's basically, you know, they're degenerate, right? So your Yukawa coupling to the 3 of them is basically the same. When you come down to, say, the normal hierarchy or the inverted hierarchy, what's going on here is in the normal hierarchy, you've got 1 heavy state and 2 light states. And the heavy state is 50% muon neutrino, 50% tau neutrino. So there's the muon and the tau. And there's an upper limit on how much electron neutrino is in that heavy state. In the inverted hierarchy, the electron neutrino lives all up here, together with half of the muon neutrino and half of the tau neutrino, and the other half is light. Okay? So that's the picture behind these branching ratios. The important thing to notice is that either you always have a non-tau decay mode, which is at least 1/3, okay? So here you go to mu a significant amount of the time. Here you've got mu and emu each 1/3 of the time. Here you've got emu at 50%. Okay? So that gives you some nice signatures to look for at the LHC. First of all, left limits, because Higgs to tau mu is somewhat smaller than in the usual 2 Higgs doublet models that you look for at left, okay? It's not so, the limits are not so good from the tau channel. And so what we did actually was we looked at left lepton search exclusions. So selectron pair production or synuon pair production. And if you take the neutralino mass at zero, the kinematics are exactly the same. Okay? So you've got scalar particles pair produced going to a neutral massless particle and a charged one. And then basically we just read off the limits, taking the conservative end of these branching ratios, we get constraints sort of in the sort of like 63-ish up to about 83 GeV, depending on the lightest neutrino mass and limit on the charge neutron mass. Okay, so what about LHC? Basically, you have to pair produce because these guys don't couple the quarks. And probably the best channel is charge six pair production, because here you only have one charged lepton and then a bunch of neutrinos. And here you just have missing energy. Okay. So the K's are two nice, stable on collector, stable on detector distance scale fermions. Okay. And another nice feature of this is, remember I said that the decays are identical to the singly charged peaks of the type 2 seesaw, this SU2 triplet, but the production is different, because the production is through both photon and Z exchange. The Z component of it depends on the isospin of the charged peaks. In the type 2 seesaw model, the isospin of this guy is zero. In the SU2 doublet model, the isospin of this guy is plus a half. Okay? And that actually gives you about a factor of a two and a half difference in cross section between the doublet model and the SU2 triplet. The doublet model is larger, fortunately. Of course, I should say the main interest in collider modes in this model are doubly charged takes pair production. So that's another signature that would let you tell it apart. So we're currently in the process of looking at LHC signatures. The signal is charged takes pair production, so basically two muons of missing PP or electrons or the combination. The major backgrounds are mostly W pairs, TT bar, and then to some extent just dielectron plus missing energy production through those modes. The selection cuts that we're sort of settling down on are basically some lepton selection cuts and missing PT cut. We vetoed jets to get rid of most of the top background, and we also cut out the Z pole to get rid of these guys. And then we're cutting on a variable that we're calling HT prime for want of a better name, which is the scalar sum of the two lepton PTs and the missing PT. And basically, we're just cutting it twice the mass of this guy, and that takes out most of our W background as well. So this looks actually promising for discovery with relatively modest luminosity, and I should say we're working at 14 PeV. Of course, as the charge sheet gets heavier, it gets harder pretty quickly. So that's basically it. And just to conclude, I would say that the LHC studies of charge takes production, charge takes discovery prospects, right, are pretty well developed for the type 2 model, right, and thus for the MSSM. For other models, you basically lose out in a lot of cases because you just don't have that production mode that the LHC searches are based on. In other cases, you can just copy over the searches and reinterpret them, like for the Flick-Chung-Higgs doublet model, with charged things going to top bottom. For the other models, there are really new phenomenological and experimental studies I would say are needed. We're looking at this for the neutrino mass model, and we'll just pose the question, is there any chance for tau-tau plus missing energy in charged things pair production? Here the answer may be no. Okay, thank you.
In the minimal supersymmetric model, generally the prediction is that the Higgs mass is light, in fact, even lighter than the minimal data in the model. So, what happens here?
Okay. So, in a generic 2D, so the MSSM scalar potential is a special case of the general two Higgs doublet model scalar potential, because in the MSSM, the scalar potential comes from basically D terms in the superpotential. It comes from the Higgs chordic couplings are related to the gauge couplings. That forces a certain pattern that results in the second doublet essentially giving only very small contributions to the electroweak precision fit that predicts a light Higgs. Okay? So things are consistent with the electroweak precision fit, and also the little h in the MSSF has to be light because of just the structure of the scalar potential. In a general two Higgs doublet model, not only do you have more free parameters, so you can crank up the mass of the standard model like Higgs, but you also have freedom with freedom in the second doublet, essentially, if you introduce an isospin splitting in the mass. So you make the charged Higgs heavier than the neutral guys, or vice versa, you'll generate contributions to basically the T parameter that can allow you to have a heavier Higgs. There was a paper by, say, Barbieri, Paul, and someone a couple of years ago looking at using a second doublet for improved naturalness of a heavier standard model like Higgs. So you can always, you can play around with parameters and open up that range, and so you can actually push things higher, but you don't have to. Does that answer the question?
Well, what's the prediction?
Oh, so it's...
What do we look for in the mass?
Between the left lower bound and about a TeV.
What's the answer? She wants to know, and then she'll give you her prediction.
So you said in the tonic Unix doublet model, tension speed is not constrained from the path because of the perturbativity of the bottom of the cover coupling.
Ah, great, yeah.
So, and so you had one plot with...
How you cover coupling. It's constrained by the how you cover coupling. Yeah.
It is constrained.
Yeah.
And that's why you cannot go higher than 200, right?
Yeah, well, 200, the how
you
cover coupling...
You had a plot with 200.
The how you cover coupling is about 2. When tangent is 200. Yeah. So you get like a factor of 2, right, compared to the bottom.
And it's still viable? I mean from
other
constraints on tension speed not coming in?
The constraint is really only... So that there's a theoretical constraint of perturbativity, and then there's the experimental constraints. And really, that's it. Yeah, leptonic tau decay, lepton universality is really the main constraint, and even that's not terribly strong.
Just a quick question for this neutrino mass model signature: do you have to worry about any weird backgrounds, such as W plus jet, where jet fakes a lepton?
Oh yes,
and is that
we're looking at those. Yeah. The other thing to worry about is Z plus jet, where you get faintness and PT. I mean, really, anytime you get two leptons and missing PT by whatever means, that's going to contribute. Cutting out the Z pole, we hope, will kill most of the Z plus jet faintness and PT, but we want to get some sort of semi-quantitative estimate of that. And W plus jet, certainly, it basically, the jet fake rate is going to tell you what that is. But this HT cut should probably kill a lot of that as well.
Okay.
Let's thank Heather again.
You probably have it.